Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined actually completely in the studio, one of the few times we've done that, starting with my good friend Matt Graham. How are you, Matt?
I'm very good, Mike. Thank you for having us.
And my other friend, and actually I should say co-host of Red Centre Podcast, Jason. How are you, sir?
Very well, Mike.
So this week we're going to do fun look at Night at the Museum 2. I call it Night at the Museum 2. It's actually Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian in countries other than Australia, but apparently in countries outside the USA they had to change the name because people were too ignorant as to the nature of the Smithsonian. Now, have you guys been to the Smithsonian?
Yeah, love it.
You've actually been?
Yeah, I took my folks and my family there for a holiday a couple of years ago, and we were there for 5 weeks and toured all around, and that was pretty much everyone's highlight was the Smithsonian.
Oh, really?
Of all the places, you know, we went to Disney World and you name it, and that was the highlight. We didn't allow enough time to see it. It's fantastic.
Have you been, Matt?
I haven't been, but I've always wanted to. So one day I will get there.
Jace, is the Smithsonian in the film, in terms of your memory of it, is it a kind of an accurate portrayal of what the museums actually look like, or is it a fictitious?
No, absolutely. It's totally accurate. I mean, one of the amazing things about the film, which we'll touch on later, is that they built that whole main entrance to the air and space with the Wright Flyer hanging in the roof. That was all totally a build. But yeah, that was the joy of the film for me, was seeing that all again and getting it brought it right back. It was very accurate. Yeah.
Well, let's discuss what we thought of the film before we get into the visual effects. I must admit, I went and saw it with two kids under the age of 12, and they thought it was just terrific. And I would say that that's probably the target audience. It's not a film I think we can judge on the basis of strict realism. We've got to judge on whether or not the visual effects, you know, helped the story. So just as we discuss the story, for me, obviously, a couple of massive holes and plot things, but you know, did it matter? I mean, what do you think, Jace?
No, it didn't matter. I went with a couple of kids older than 12, but not much older, and I thought it was great. I quite liked it. We, as a family, I'm sure we've got the DVD somewhere of the original. We liked the film. I mean, this is one of those things, I suppose, as a sequel, it's as good as the original, which makes a change for sequels. The effects didn't get in the way of the plot or take you out of the movie. I mean, we all liked it as a film. It was, you know, quite fun.
Good, wholesome fun.
Yeah, actually, possibly, you know, effects were, on the whole, were better than the first.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the actual original film that you mentioned increased attendance at the Natural History Museum by, I believe, about something like 20%.
Yeah.
And so thus it was that the Smithsonian was actually quite keen to have people come in and film. Though I read somewhere, I think, that they primarily filmed during the day, do you know?
Yeah, they weren't allowed to close the museum for filming, so it had to be done during the day, like hours. So I don't know what parts they filmed there. I mean, there's a lot of bits
walking
through. Not at
the museum, during the day at the museum.
Exactly. But I don't know which parts they would have done. I mean, there's a lot of bits and pieces with Ben Stiller walking through hallways and stuff like that. But as Jay said, yeah, they had to build the entire Air and Space Museum up in a shipyard in Vancouver. So that's a big freaking build.
Yeah, it was a massive build. They had a trouble, as you say, build it and set it up in a shipyard. They had trouble finding the space to build that. It was a 4-month build, and it just that I only found that out after I saw the film that they actually built it, because I'd been there and I'd watching. You know, when you look at the scope of the set and the it is just staggering that they built that. I mean, a lot of the props they did sort of bring in from third parties, but I just was utterly amazed.
But I read they even matched the light fittings and the amount of LED lights and the lunar landing. That was amazing. A lot of effort.
It's a massive place. I mean, there's a lot of stuff they probably...
I think Kitty Hawk travelled a little further in this film than it did in the original of the above-mentioned...
And yeah. It seems to be made out of titanium now, but it's minor details.
Than spruce and canvas.
The damn side more manoeuvrable, but hey, that's by and the by.
Be easily flown by, you know, people with very little aeronautical training.
I guess my only criticism of the film, if it's before we get into the visual effects, is there were a couple of, I thought, standout performances of people that I expected to come back and reappear in a bigger role. In fact, the security guard that he steals the ID pass from, the guy from, I think, Superbad.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, exactly. He was somebody that I thought, well, that's a good character. we've set that up well now, as you tend to do in films, so that at the end, when he appears, you don't say, well, he just came out of nowhere, and, you know, where are all the other security guards? And yet that didn't sort of happen. I thought there was a few occasions of things like that where they kind of set up something nice. I mean, I would have liked to have seen that happen. And as I segue into the visual effects, one of the big ones of those for me was the paintings and going into the paintings. What do you think of that, Jase?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. I'm not totally up with modern art, but I knew a fair few of the things they featured, you know, the Kiss, 1945 or whatever it is, into Times Square. It's just the transitions in and out of that. As a director, that would have been a world of hurt, and they pulled it off excellently.
I thought that was a really good sequence.
Yeah. The whole being able to pulling the pitchforks out of American Gothic and the reactions, and obviously every time you shoot a shot with a painting, you can't just shoot one plate of that, you know, of the background pass of the painting. You've got to shoot one that matches every angle that you shoot your foreground pass for. You know, does that make sense? You know, so it was everything sort of matched and worked in beautifully to me. All that the interactions from jumping in and out of paintings and pulling objects in and out of the frames was, I thought it was,
and the depth,
worked really, really well.
So
again,
the depth alone in the paintings, just awesome.
So that was one of those things that I thought, well, having set up the paintings, which is a new device for this film, that'll be used in the, I mean, obviously there was going to be a big battle at the end, there was going to be a big resolve. I expected that to be like a chase sequence through the whole museum that went in and out of those paintings, and then the security guard, the kid that got ripped off, kind of comes in and accidentally stumbles and saves the day. If I'd been writing it, I think that's the direction I'd have gone in, just because I felt like they'd set up these great comic devices, they'd set them up with a very good premise, and then we kind of just didn't get back to them again, and that would have been, I think, kind of fun. I would have liked to see more of those paintings.
It was a bit sort of, it did, I suppose, feel a bit tokenistic. You go into this whole world of 1945 and, you know, VE Day or whatever it was, then you sort of, you know, have a few little gags like, oh, wow, four bars in 1945, and he can get that signal on his phone.
But, and, you know, there's going to be a sequel, a third film.
I'm sure.
What was it, $80 million in the opening weekend or something? It'll have to come back for a third. So they need something to lead into the next film.
Well, let's discuss visual effects now. Matt, I think you've got the sort of stats. Who were the main sort of companies that were working on it?
Main companies? Rhythm and Hughes did a huge bulk of the work, around about 535 shots. MPC also contributed heavily, with a lot of mostly the animals in the early part of the film, which we'll talk about in a sec, but I think they nailed those. That was about 45 shots there. Other players were Cafe FX, Digiscope, Digital Domain, Pixel Playground, The Orphanage, and Lola.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got to say, I think Rhythm and Hughes, we don't maybe discuss Rhythm and Hughes as much as we discuss some of the other bigs, like, I don't know, ILM or DD or whatever, but Rhythm and Hughes has been around for a heck of a long time. It's since like about 87, and they just, I know, some really, really good work. Of course, they went very well with the Golden Compass, which, of course, won the Oscar, but also, you know, back in the day with Babe. And for a company that has been pretty much, you know, stable since the 80s, it's a pretty remarkable achievement in this day.
Yeah, they've got a back catalogue way into 80s, haven't they, Mike? I mean, a lot of that, I mean, obviously they started doing amazing stuff with all of that muzzle replacement and the Babe work. You know, they did get known for their talking animals.
They're very well known for character animation.
Yeah, absolutely. But obviously they've really parlayed that into an amazing career going forward, when there's a lot of houses of that era that kicked off when they did and were kicking goals when they were, that are now not no longer playing.
Yeah, I mean, they worked on Night at the Museum 1. But, I mean, the company actually started with some guys that were ex Robert Abelson Associates, and I don't know if you remember Robert Abelson Associates, but this is really going back. But they were sort of, they did this spot, the Sexy Robot, which I think was for canned goods, but it was just landmark stuff. Stuff out of Robert Abelson Associates was just, at the time, awesome. But the thing about, I think they even worked on Tron. But anyway, the thing about the Rhythm and Hughes guys is that in the early days they went proprietary. And I was talking about this with someone on the weekend. They went proprietary in their workflow. So they did a lot of tools that were in-house, including their compositing tools and stuff like that, where everybody else was going workstation. And, of course, now it's swung back the other way, that you'll notice that when we talk to a lot of people, for example, we do interviews over at FX Guide, that they'll have set up proprietary pipelines, have proprietary tools to do stuff. And that really was out of vogue for a while. And Rhythm and Hughes, you know, just, I guess, had such a good in-house setup that they just stuck with it. Because, I mean, Matt, quite a lot of the tools that were used by someone, say the London houses, were their own proprietary tools, weren't they?
Yeah, MPC used their own proprietary stuff again. They were using all different bits and pieces, like rigid body dynamic solvers, PAPI for a lot of the, as I said earlier on in the film, where the animals are breaking out of cages and things like that. So that was used.
Do you know who did like the hippos and the
that was MPC again.
Because I think that was excellent.
The hippos and hippos, kangaroos. Well, obviously the octopus, but we'll get to him. He was awesome. But yeah, a lot of that stuff was absolutely outstanding because of the fact that it was really interacting. Everything felt really embedded and really not just like something comped over the top of it. All because a lot of the stuff's coming in and out of shadows. The whole place is lit at night. There's a lot of extremes of lighting in the place. You know, coming out of animals, coming out of crates and things. That really, everything really felt like it was lit in that environment, and that really just helped for me sell it in, and again, not take any of those effects out of the film. And what was amazing with all of them, and they were all just on the screen for, I don't know, 10 seconds. Some of them,
yeah,
and
single asset elements, not repeated later on.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say as well.
Oh, they might have been used later on when the sort of everything sort of goes nuts, but essentially, you know, they're not
things that you wouldn't sort of necessarily be able to invest vast amounts of R&D into, because they're literally only on the they break out of a box kind of.
Yet they all look like they'd been made to survive an entire film.
We know what a roo looks like.
We are used to looking at roos, and we know when they're bad.
They were good kangaroos this time.
I think Rhythm and Hughes actually worked on the octopus as well as Lincoln and the squirrel and stuff. I thought the squirrel was one of those characters that was really nicely done, the fur and stuff. I mean, the Einstein bobbleheads and stuff were more, in a sense, easier to do.
But yeah,
whereas you get the fur stuff that had the squirrel, and I thought that was really nice. Like, looked really believable. And
squirrel was great.
Octavius riding on him was a good gag. And
well, the trick with, I mean, the great thing about the squirrel was that a lot of the time, obviously, he's got,
Octavius?
I forget his name. Yeah, Octavius. I was thinking of the actor's name. What's his name? Steve Coogan. He is obviously riding him, so there's a lot of comping.
That was Steve Coogan as in 24-Hour Party People.
As in
24-Hour Party People, most excellent film. It's not a visual effects film, but if you know who New Order is, then watch that film.
Right, that's the sort of docudrama recreation of the history of
if you care about
the band.
Yeah, Joy Division.
Right.
Then, yes, it was just one of the greatest films of that kind of period.
Sorry, yeah, just as in, and also, yeah, Tropic Thunder and tons of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, the director on Tropic Thunder. But obviously, so he's riding the, he's riding the squirrel. Yeah. So that's all comped in really well. Again, the squirrel really felt like he was to scale. Steve Coogan really felt like he was, really looked like he was really well matted in, because obviously it's quite hard when you've got someone who's probably riding on a green motion base. Right, yeah. And obviously you've got the fur and the sort of skin of the squirrel needs to wrap around his legs and interact with it. And you have to animate what would come first? You animate the squirrel and then you have to program the motion base to copy that, or do you just shoot him static and then match him to the animation?
I imagine you'd go for the performance first. So
yeah.
Because you can adjust the performance of the squirrel, you'd go for the performance of the actor. Because if Steve does this really great performance and a really funny bit that you want to put in the script, then you're going to adjust the squirrel to make its body work for that bit of when he delivers that line.
Then just guessing, then you've got the motion base is probably being live puppeteered on set with all the data being recorded.
I know, you probably previs the shot. I mean, what I would do, and I don't know if they
but
did
if
this.
But if you can't previs if they're, as we say, there's a lot of impromptu kind
of. Well, no, but let's say you're the director, right, and you come to me and say, I want to do that shot. Which is sort of, you know, not an unreasonable thing. We would probably pre-visit to get, is this the kind of move that you want? And you'd be like, yeah, actually, I'd like it to rear up like it's a stallion kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we'd go, oh, okay, well, for that, we're talking like this, and do you want the camera, say, here at the side? And you go, or above? And you're like, no, I want to be down at squirrel level. So, okay, well, this is the kind of shot you're after. Yeah. That then feeds the motion base to sort of rear it up, assuming that the camera is at the side, and we place the 35 camera at the side, filmed Steve on the rig doing the rear up.
Yeah.
But we don't have detailed squirrel animation yet because you've got to decide which bit of Steve's performance you like.
Yeah, that's right.
And let's say you're like, oh, I really like that bit, but his arms are not quite the right position or whatever. We, you know, you could tweak it. But after that, we'd go, okay, well, let's not do the cape, for example, in camera because that's got to really interact with the fur. Let's, you know, put that in as digital or as digital extension or whatever. Mm. And then we'd do the squirrel under Steve. When you're happy with it, just polish it off. And that's how, and that's certainly how I would do it.
Right.
And I imagine that's pretty close to how the guys at Rhythm and Hughes did it.
So you wouldn't be too fussed about getting data from the base or whatever. You just kind of just get one to match the other.
But, I mean, if it's a motion control rigged base, you'd have repeatability in the move, which, of course, could feed back into the 3D. But what's going to define the 3D, in a sense, is not the course movement of the lift up, because that's really not that hard. It's the having the musculature system under the fur and having the fur react correctly.
Mm.
And so it's like on a scale of 10 units of work, getting the move and the lifting up bits like a kind of a 2, getting the shading, lighting and interaction with the furs like the other 8. So whether or not you got the move from the motion control rig controlled gimbal for the lift up or not, probably not as much of an issue as getting just terrific lighting reference and great integration into the background.
Okay.
2 points, though, on that. I wasn't as sold, I don't know what you thought, Matt, but I wasn't as sold on the grass outside the White House where the squirrel was found. I just felt like...
It wasn't as realistic as a lot of the other things, but, you know, I think it had its perfect place of comedic value. I mean, it was kind of hokey, like
Honey,
I Shrunk the Kids. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's see, and for me, it was, and I looked at it and sort of thought, why is that not working for me? And
it did stand out a bit, didn't it?
Well, what came for me is in the film that Pixar did, A Bug's Life, they did this great translucency of everything down at microscopic level. Like you saw through the grass, it had a real translucent quality to it.
This grass definitely didn't get to that level. But again, because of the genre and the type of film it was, it didn't need to.
But you could have done that because you had a strong backlight source from the White House itself, and it's completely valid that would have floodlights out the front and stuff. It just, as you said, it felt like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids when you were in close, yet the squirrel didn't.
Because the squirrel was quite photoreal. Yeah. Then you had the foreground element, which felt a little bit like a, you know, like a plate.
But a lot of the miniature, like a lot of the miniature people stuff really did stick out. And I don't know if it was, you know, just to help the kids understand. Obviously, it didn't keep accurate depth of field and stuff. Mm. But
my theory on that is that the edges of the comped elements were soft. And my only thought about this, and I don't know if it's true or not because I'm completely speculating now, is that if I was trying to comp somebody over a background, I shot them completely green screen and it's all fine and dandy, then I could clearly blur the background and composite them over the top. But if I had some elements that were captured in camera and I wanted to have a shallower depth of field, it's a much more difficult problem to separate two foreground elements from each other and blur. Because normally if you blur the element, let's say somebody's standing in front of a pillar, that's real, into an environment where the pillar should be out of focus, but because we're not actually shooting macro because we've got an actor standing next to the pillar, it isn't. Trying to blur the pillar, at the point that the pillar touches the shoulder of the actor, it's kind of really hard to blur behind the actor's shoulder. You tend to get us the line of the actor's shoulder having a bit of a blur on it. But that's exactly the opposite of what you get on a long lens with macro photography. You get these normally gorgeously sharply cut foreground elements, and then, you know, it's like that long lens depth of field thing. You get like the bokeh really just kicks it, but it's as if they're very, very much on two separate layers.
Yeah, that's what makes the foreground look so sharp, is it that pops. The background is so soft and the lines and the edges are also so crisp. But yeah, I mean, this probably would be the hardest part of this film to pull off, is all the miniature, all the little miniature people, you know, all Owen Wilson and...
I think the squid would have been a bit tricky.
Yeah. But obviously the squid is you're not trying to cheat any scale.
He's
like 6 foot high, just like you know, he's in the same sort of space as the actors. It does seem to be a bit of a trick to get right.
Well, so for example, if you even were to Google the PR shot from the first film, which has Owen Wilson on a horse in front of the train tracks, if you look carefully, the train tracks have defocus. That should mean that the arse of the horse is out of focus because Ben Stiller's lying, his head is down.
Yeah.
Owen Wilson's horse is camera right. And if you Google it, this is like the number one picture that it comes up. And on the right is the train tracks going off into the distance. So the train tracks are a perfect depth of field indicator, right? It's like camera tracks.
It's like if you were going to demonstrate depth of field.
And so what happens is you can see that the tracks are starting to get out of focus during the length of the horse, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the head of the horse would be in focus, ass would be out because the horse is facing into the picture. And, of course, the horse isn't. It's comped in 100%, you know, clean because from the video computer's point of view, it's one flat piece of imagery. You either defocus it or not.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can do mats and stuff. But the problem is that that's why it kind of sits out from the picture because it should have a gradual increasing defocus on it and yet very, right. very hard to do.
Yeah, you're trying to make those foreground passes have as shallow a depth of field as possible and shoot them all absolutely wide angle and you know, maybe even cheat the focus that little bit further forward as much as you can to throw those backgrounds out. And it just doesn't scale, does it? Depth of field is obviously completely different.
And I like it when you get those shots where, you know, like the shoulder of somebody is out of focus, their nose is just in focus, and by the time you get to their ear, they're out of focus.
Yeah.
And that's that kind of really classic shallow depth of field that we love in photography and stuff. And yet, what I was getting was, if they're facing the camera, they're fully in focus, and just the edges of their shoulder is kind of like a soft-edged mat.
Yeah.
And I wasn't loving that. Now, my kids couldn't give a damn.
It's all about the kids.
But
what would be great is that ideally maybe when the larger format Reds come out, you want to be able to start shooting this stuff. You want to scale up the size of the film you're working with, I guess. That'll help. If you almost want to start shooting this stuff on medium format or on 70mm or something like that. So
we got that shallow depth of field on the IMAX parts of Dark Knight, didn't we?
Yeah.
Because there were shots of Michael Caine shot on IMAX where literally that was happening. Like his nose, I reckon, was just soft. His eyes were in focus and his ears were out. It was like 1 centimeter depth of field.
Yeah, because you're
like, Michael, don't move.
Yeah, because you're shooting everything on twice as tight a lens.
What we need is the ultimate plug-in for depth of field. So you can just, you know, plug it in, set the parameters of your depth of field and off you go.
Well, as you know, Mike says, it's very hard to soften off stuff behind people and get in there and in your foreground plate, you know, add in that depth of field that's obvious in your background plate. But
because one of the problems is that if you do make it like we described, it kind of looks stuck on.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you always get that layered thing.
The layered look is what you get from real photography.
Yeah, yeah.
Matt, you mentioned the octopus, and I thought the octopus stuff worked really well. And we have an article over on fxguide.com where we show like the previs, the clean plate, the giant stand-in sort of rubber squid they had and the practical water devices for when he's throwing water from the painting on the squid.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, that series.
But I just genuinely thought the squid, I bought it, you know. Like,
oh, totally. It was wonderful. I mean, one of the things that was, I think, helped sell it in is that I guess they stayed pretty true to his biology, you know. They didn't screw with it to make it look cartoony so it could do, you know, smile and frown reactions. It was pretty, you know, it was anatomically correct, and it looked, you know, looked really real, and had all that sort of you know, slime and ooze on him. He was really, I mean, the whole interaction with Ben Stiller when he kind of gets smudged up into his cheek and gets tentacled right up, their faces are quite together.
That was great.
It was, you know, interactivity worked
really,
so
really had
well.
A personality through the suction cups, yeah. And you know, the little gesture with the eyes without making excessive kind of cartoony moves.
Yeah, exactly. No, I totally bought it. Again, all its interaction on set, the way the water, throwing buckets of water on it, how that interacted around it, and its light and shadow, and this was sensational.
Yeah, I mean, there was an enormous amount of depth in the effects, in the sense there were a lot of background characters and stuff coming through, you know, cherubs and stuff. And
I did not like the cherubs.
I did. I thought they were good.
I think it's the songs that the cherubs were singing would drive me nuts.
Am I right in thinking that was the Jonas Brothers?
They are the Jonas Brothers. That was pointed out to me by my audience with me.
I think I
had no idea.
Jonas Brothers are.
I was blissfully ignorant. And
your daughter is not old enough yet, but just wait.
Yeah,
The Bay City Rollers, the Cassidy of our generation. They're just like, you know, yes, Jonas Brothers.
Mm. Apart from that sappy, sickening sort of cross-promotion tie-in Disney crap, it was I quite liked the way they were rendered and their sort of marble look, and, you know, the reflectance on them. Again, their shadows, for me, they all sat quite well, all embedded quite well.
Some of the statues
they were
awesome.
Pretty stupid. I mean, overall as a character, didn't, you know, really. I mean, apart from sort of, I guess, foretelling the romantic sort of side of things between...
in case you couldn't see it coming.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And I have another piece of trivia for you. You know, this is the second movie that featured both Abraham Lincoln and Napoleon. Do you want to guess what the first was? It's right up your alley, Matt.
Have you been eating fantails on the weekend or something?
I'll give you a hint. It was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Say, right. Yeah, that would be...
Okay.
Yes. So did you like... Because the reason I brought this up is, did you like our marble Abraham Lincoln? Because that was an interesting problem, because in a sense you want it to look marbly, and that, by every stretch of the imagination, is not something that bends, and then you needed it to have almost cloth-like characteristics as he sort of did stuff.
I think it was a bit too fluid for my liking, especially when he's back in the monument, he's doing little head twitches and stuff, and that just seemed a little too fluid for my liking. I would like to see a slightly more rigid animation, I guess.
Mm. I quite liked him. I bought him. I thought he was pretty good. I think, oddly enough, the thing that got in the way for me with that, and also with the thinker, what's he? I guess he's made of bronze. Mm-hmm. Is the sound design. Constant sort of grinding of marble against marble and metal against metal. Just shut up. We get it. It's made of bronze. It's made of marble. Whatever. We get it. Can we just hear the guy talk? So it just felt a bit sort of heavy-handed there. That's, if anything, weirdly enough, the sound took me out of the film. But I kind of bought Abe. I thought he was cool.
I like some of the other sculptures. I loved the Venus sculpture. I thought she was done really well. And the Degas ballet dancer. I love that one. Mm. And the giant balloon dog is my favourite.
Jeff Clunes, yeah. Who doesn't love a giant Jeff Clunes dog? Eh? We had one in Sydney, the puppy, you know, when you planted the flowers outside the
yes.
The museum.
He was fantastic. I didn't know that was Goons Clunes.
I love modern art. And, by the way, I think the more interesting integration problems came around the Capone characters, because the Capone and his guys being black and white had some issues for me. What about you guys?
I for me, that was probably the only sort of not so great element in the film was black and white Al Capone integrated into the film. You said you saw soft mats around something else, which I didn't see, but I definitely saw some sort of soft matting around those guys. I suppose maybe it was because, I don't know why, because I suppose black and white within colour felt sort of, for some reason, amongst all of the other tricksy stuff, that felt really sort of tricksy to me. So I guess I was looking for how they did it.
I was thinking about that, because you mentioned that before, and I think I've worked out what it is. If they were actually monochrome in the environment, then they would have some... sort of general ambient illumination color on them. So in other words, if I was in a bluish environment but a monochrome character, there'll be a bluish tinge to my black shadows.
That would have been cool to see.
What we got was, I'm going to roto them out and take all the color out.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like they were... Like, I thought it would have been cooler if they'd been a black and white character in that they had no color on them. But what it really felt like is, I'm going to just completely desat the outline. And so had they sort of felt monochromey, because I mean, it worked terrifically well in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but we're in a completely sort of artificial environment.
Because it was that sort of cartoony environment. But this, to me, I suppose it just, I mean, I suppose the technique took me out of the film a bit. But then also, as I say, there was definitely sort of soft matting around them, which was just a technical thing.
I think they graded it very monochrome to make the point.
Yeah.
But I think they shouldn't have done that. I think they should have just subtly done it so they were monochrome and had no colour, but actually had ambient colour, and thus you just kind of read them as being without colour, as opposed to, look at what we're doing, these are black and white cutouts. Or done it...
Solve it with wardrobe and makeup. That would have been just awesome.
Completely monochrome characters. Well, the other thing I was going to say is...
Maybe they did, and I'm seeing matte lines that weren't there.
Or if they went the other way and made them like newsprint, you know, the...
Yeah. But if he gets brought into modern day, why shouldn't he just become colour? I mean, Amelia Earhart, why wasn't she black and white then?
Because she was like a wax mannequin that came alive.
Okay,
and I think
they were cardboard cutouts in the
exactly, and then they still had a 3D dimension.
Right,
what's going on with that?
Okay,
it's interesting actually. In the poster for the film, Al Capone is in colour, So I don't know if they just ran out of money and couldn't afford to make it black and white in the poster.
Yeah, because it's really hard to do Photoshop color. Hey, Jace, you mentioned earlier the aerospace museum, the fact that you'd actually visited it, and that it was not inaccurate in its scale and size and stuff. Can you tell us how they actually pulled that off? Because presumably you can't, you know, smash the place up and...
Well, literally, obviously, for the live action, they built a map. There was a four-month build to totally recreate the essentially that main foyer area. But one of the other sections, which totally blew me away because I was watching the film thinking, oh, my God, how have they done this, was there was a sequence when they Amelia and Ben Stiller's character jump on the Wright Flyer and basically fly through the building. There's a fantastic sort of like, I guess you'd say, chase plane angle behind them, which I just thought, wow, this is brilliant. How are they doing it? Must have had to build this in 3D, the whole air and space, because essentially they're flying from one end of the building to the other. But it was actually a physical model. It was like...
like a miniature?
Yeah, it built a miniature, 80 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot miniature. 50 people, you know, it took weeks to build this thing. Yeah, and
the guys over at New Deal did that. Awesome job.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether the foreground plane was a CGI element, or maybe that was CGI, but obviously the background plates, the fly through, the point of view shots flying through the museum was literally a MoCo fly through. On a bigature, really. I'm not going to say it's a miniature. That again, that is an awesome piece of
so
piece
much
of
detail
building.
And again, really accurate.
Yeah, it really accurate. And obviously, it's not just building the space. You've got it, the place is loaded with, you know, Saturn V rocket engines and X1, you know, Bell experimental jet aircraft, and you've got to model each one of these things and suspend it. And I just And then obviously remove them as you fly the camera through the room, I guess. It's just outstanding. So, that, I mean, apart from the amazing build that would have been, that was one of my standout shots. I really liked that that whole sort of sequence, despite, as you say, the fact that the Wright Flyer magically flew 50 times longer than it actually ever did in real life.
Yeah, I thought it was convenient that the planes were left fueled up as well.
But, you know. Amazing, yeah.
Because right. You do that in a museum.
But hey, this is, yeah. This is
kids did not care. No. Thought it was fun.
Didn't care.
Went very well. Okay, so overall, we thought the effects were really good. Maybe a little bit of work on the miniatures would. When I say the miniatures, now I mean the miniature characters, not the miniatures. We don't have, I think, any criticism of the New Deal Studios miniatures, but I mean, you know, the small characters.
Again, that's really hard. That is really hard stuff, as we touched on, to get right.
But it served a purpose. It served what it was supposed to do. It's a kids' film. We went after photoreal in every shot, and it was just a bit of fun.
Again, I think that the all the miniature stuff, all the small people stuff, is a lot better done this time around than the first time. It's, as I say, this is actually a case where the sequel is actually either better effects and or, you know, they've probably thrown more money at it this time around, and it looks like they're getting their money back.
Yeah, no, totally. And you know, the work that Rhythm and Hughes did is to be applauded. I think it's really good. And I, as we said earlier, I think it shows the most in the fact that you've got these secondary characters. These you know, if you're going to have a major character in the film, you're going to put a lot of time and effort in. They appear in a lot of shots. It makes sense. But when you've got these small characters in the background and they don't let the film down, it's that attention to detail I think we really appreciate. And so good shout out to those guys because that was great work.
Awesome work. I mean, there's a lot of stuff where they've actually done stuff for real, which is what I just doing research afterwards. There's an amazing shot of the Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Vega pulling up outside the
National History Museum,
museum in New York.
Yeah,
and it's taxiing down the road, and I thought, well, this has got to be a build. This has got to be you know, CGI plane, can't possibly do this, can't possibly block off, you know, Central Park. But no, it's for real. They made the Lockheed, built a one-to-one Lockheed Vega for them to fly in. It doesn't actually fly, but they actually did, taxied it, blocked off the streets, taxied it down the street in New York at night, and it's just utterly amazing. And actually obviously, there was a lot of good effects there. Actually, they actually made it land on the street in out the front, and obviously then take off and you know, take off up to the sky again. I thought that was, again, Pretty yes, impressive.
And my girls particularly loved the Three Stooges homage with the two monkeys slapping Ben Stiller. So
that was pretty impressive.
Yeah. That, and I've got to tell you, that scene that we spoke about before with, is it the guy from Superbad? Is it,
yeah, it's not Judd Apatow, is it? No.
No. It's
the Night Guard.
Joshua
or the
Hill?
Day Guard scene.
Right.
Yeah. Jonah Hill?
Right. Yep. Jonah Hill. Right.
But anyway, the sequence with the light, you know, the
flashlight
stuff I've seen that you
martial arts
wouldn't
thing.
Believe, like what, I'm not going to tell you, kind of. I thought it was really funny. Yeah, the flashlight was really, apparently somebody told me that was it you, Matt, that told me that was improvised, a lot of that.
A lot of, yeah, I've read somewhere that only about 25% of the film was actually scripted and all of it was improvised, which is kind of why it feels very, you know, mashed together at some points, but... You know,
some of those scenes do seem a bit stretched. You know, the whole, I don't think of his name, who
Hank
played
Azaria.
Hank Azaria. Yeah. When he's sort of, do not put your hand past this line. Do not
touch. I thought that was really funny. My girls thought that was hysterically funny.
It was like they went to this, it was exactly mimicked. What they did was mimicking the action. They went to this line and they crossed it. They went on and on and on. It's funny. I mean, kids loved it. They thought it was very funny. You know, that.
I thought the Vader thing was pretty funny with the
Vader
Oscar
and
Vader.
Oscar the Grouch. Was, yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, you've got all these properties and, you know, a lot of it's almost public domain, almost, obviously, apart from the fact that Disney keeps amazingly tampering with the words public domain. But,
What do you mean?
Well, the you know, they keep extending. Theoretically, I'm speaking out my ass, copyright wise. But obviously, things like Mickey Mouse theoretically should be in public domain by now. But magically, through the power of in the Senate, that they keep sort of twisting and distorting the copyright laws to you know, keep it, you know, all in the family. So you know.
Oh, I get it. I know what you're saying.
Right, and obviously, and Disney owns the whole Sesame Street thing, so. Yeah, it's just amazing how they can keep a hold on a character that's probably was invented 40 years ago. So anyway, that's a whole different podcast.
That is a whole different podcast. Well, yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for taking time to talk to us about this. Next one we're going for is Terminator 4 or Terminator Salvation.
Yeah, which you've seen already, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I'm keen to see it. I have been slightly put off by a lot of the reviews I've heard so far, but I'm not a huge fan of McGee, but we'll see what that one. When that one turns up here in Australia, down in the Antipodes. But I'm sure he'll pull it off, I'm sure.
There are some very interesting aspects to the Terminator 4 film. And I spoiler alert, see the film before next week's T4 coverage, because we're going to go in-depth on one of the big spoilers in the film.
Okay.
This has been a joint production of FX Guide and Pixel Corps. We want to thank Kristen Martin, our producer, editor, publisher and website and general Twitter feeder. And Jace, you're on the Twitters.
I am. I'm Wingrove, and my website, jasonwingrove.com.
And I'm not on
and
the
you're
Twitter.
Not.
You're not. You're
on the odd one
my
out.
Face, Facebook-y
you're on Mike's face.
You can post me a letter or postcard.
You can post me a letter.
Write on my wall or whatever it is that you do.
Actually, I quite like writing people letters. It's surprising in this day and age. You sit down to write a letter. For a start, there's no undo button. Go figure, right? But secondly, isn't it quite nice getting a letter?
No, that's not a wake home. I know, it's weird.
It's just bills I get in the letterbox.
Until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening. See you for Terminator Salvation.